Well, it is good to see all of you here this morning. It's probably a surprise to see me this morning. Lee has been a little busy of late. You can imagine how. And so he asked if I would take the class this morning, and some men asked that I speak. So this is more than your system can bear. I'm very sorry, but I'll try to make it as painless as possible. Now, I'm told that you're in Romans 7, and this brief outline will show us, I think, the three major parts that we need to keep in mind before us as we go through. 1-6, basically the release from the law, just as the husband and wife, and the illustration he gives here in Romans 7 makes one die and therefore the other is free. So we're free from the law, and that's Paul's illustration. That's what it is. It's an illustration. The second part of it is the purpose of the law. He shows how in Paul's own life, kind of using himself as an example, that when he reached an age where he was accountable before God, he understood that he had committed a sin. He uses the illustration again of covetousness. And we'll try to say more about that as the time goes on. And then the third part of it, the weakness of the law. The law is perfect insofar as it was used according to the reason it was given. In other words, those who used the law properly were benefited by it. There were Israelites who never understood the law. They didn't try to understand the law. They didn't try to understand God. And they didn't know that their covenant relationship with God was based upon how they treated His Word. Especially, we would say, the Ten Commandments and all that flows from them. There were a few Israelites who got it. There were David, Moses, and some others, Isaiah, who would say, "What God really wants for me is not this animal sacrifice." And they'll state it that way. God says in Isaiah 1, just close the doors, shut down the temple, don't come here anymore. I don't want your sacrifices, because every time you offer one to me, all I can see is the blood on your hands instead of the blood on the altar. And as long as you're going around killing people and not paying attention to my word, my law means nothing to you, and therefore your sacrifice means nothing to me. And that's how God had to deal with them. Now, consequently, they had all kinds of issues that they had to deal with. God's wrath came upon them, and they didn't use the law properly. They finally had just a small remnant to return and to bless the world. The salvation would come through Jesus, John 4:22. Now, the weakness of the law was that even those who used it properly, David, Moses, and others, they could be forgiven provisionally. And the old covenant. You'll see this all through Leviticus. He can't have his sins forgiven until he offers the lamb of burnt offering or the lamb and so on. They had to offer their offerings, and provisionally they were forgiven. Every year at the Day of Atonement, they had a reminder that those sins were still there. They had the previous sins they'd committed and the ones that had been sort of postponed like a promissory note in the previous offering of the Day of Atonement. And then all those are added again on this one and then done away with for another year. And it's kind of like a fellow who owes a tremendous debt, maybe $100 billion to the bank. And he goes to the banker and he says, "I can't pay. I don't have the money to pay. What do you want to do about this?" And he says, I just don't have the money. I can give you a few dollars here and there, but there's no way you can pay this debt. He says, "All right, we'll put this off for another year." So you go back next year. Now you not only owe the debt you owed last year, but all the interest that has accrued since then. Compound interest is our greatest enemy, our greatest friend, isn't it? Depending on whether you're the debtor or the creditor. So now you owe more than you did. And that's the way these were. Well, he says, "Okay, we'll put it off again." Then next year you put it off again. Finally, the man dies. But all through this time, he's coming to the banker. He's saying, "I don't have anything to pay. Now, I'm willing to do anything you ask me to do." He says, "Sign this note right here and come back next year." And he does this faithfully the rest of his life. Now, is he saved? Yes, provisionally. He's not saved in actuality until in Romans 3:25 and Hebrews 9:15, the blood of Christ that flowed on the cross flowed backward to cover all of those who were living by faith and all that that implies. They were saved by the blood of Christ just as we are. But they had to meet those conditions. A few of them got it. David was saying Psalm 51 after his great sin with Bathsheba. If you wanted to burn offerings, I would gladly bring them. But he says, I know that's not what you want. You want me. You want my heart. You want my obedience. He understood it. Very few did. But the weakness of the law is that even for those who got it, even for those who understood it, the law itself did not really release them from their sins. That's not the function of law. The function of law is to say, if you look in a mirror, you see your flaws. The law's done its job. It's condemned you. But it hasn't forgiven anything. It's just pointed out what you are. Only the mercy of God would forgive you, and in fact, go so far in forgiveness, he would give his only son to see that that would be accomplished. Now, in view of this, you see these three categories. It's obviously the law that's being spoken of all throughout Romans 7. Let's look at it in just an overview for a moment. In verse 7, I want you to notice the way he repeats himself. We'll say more about this, the Lord willing, as we go through in the text in verse 7 through verse 25. But he talks about those who are released from the law. Verse 2, verse 6, you are released from the law, having died to that thing, because you've died to that thing that held you, and so on. And he says, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Talking like this may give the impression that the problem is the law itself, that it's the fault. And he's going to point out, no, that can't be. May that never be. No, 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 no. That's not the proper conclusion. The law is not the problem. You need the law, if only to see yourself as you are. But sin has this ability to jump in and use that law in a way that's very hard on a person. You see that starting in Genesis 3. Had there been no law in the Garden of Eden, I guess we'd still be in paradise, wouldn't we? Pretty pleasant thought, isn't it? But there was a law. And my great, 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 whatever she would be, grandmother, Eve, and yours too, because we're all related, violated that law, and so did Adam. And they're kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Now, there's only one way that that could be remedied. And ultimately, that's through the Son of God. And just so you'll see, Genesis starts out, the paradise, the tree of life, the blessings, being with God, the close fellowship. How does Revelation end? Paradise of God, close blessings, relationship with Him, tree of life restored. And that's what the whole Bible is about from beginning to end. Every bit of it. All the Old Testament, every syllable of it is pointing toward that coming Christ who will be able to deliver us from these situations that we put ourselves in. So, is the law sin? No. But sin took an opportunity. Sin set up its base of operations in the view of there being a law. In other words, Satan comes to Eve in the garden and he says, you know why God says don't eat of that fruit? It's because he is jealous. He knows if you eat of that fruit, you're going to be as wise as he is. He's holding back. He's not acting in your best interest. And so distrust of God and the view that you will not surely die, the impossibility of apostasy, was taught very early on in the very first sin. So Eve says, boy, that looks good, and I'm sure it would taste good, and I desire it. So she takes and she eats. And the rest, as they say, is history. Sin took the occasion because there was a law. Now, suppose there were no law in the Garden of Eden, and Satan came and said, has God made this? No, he hadn't made any rules at all. Well, I'm going to entice you to do what? What could he entice her to do? If there's no law, there can be no condemnation for the violation of a non-law. And so sin has that relationship with the commandment. So the commandment's not sinful, but it does give an opportunity for us to break the commandment. So that in verse 8, sin taking opportunity by the commandment produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. Where there's no law, there can be no transgression. Remember chapter 4, verse 15? Where there's no law, there can be no transgression. So if God says, all right, you're free to act any way you want, think any way you want, do anything you want. There are no laws. What do we know now? There will be no sinners. Because sin is the violation of the law. But if there's a law, what are you going to have? You're going to have sinners. It can't be any other way. So he says in verse 9, illustrating it with himself, I was alive once without the law, But when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Paul was alive once. When was he alive once? Well, when he's a child and before he's accountable before God. He's not morally accountable. He's not reached an age whereby he can know and be held accountable. He was alive. He wasn't born in sin. He was born safe, S-A-F-E. He had no sins to be forgiven of. But then he starts learning the commandments. The child in the Jewish economy at the age of 12, the boy would go to his bar mitzvah, and then he's a son of the law. The girl, I think, age 13, would go to her bat mitzvah, and she would be a daughter of the law. And they would know the law. They're accountable to act in harmony with the law. When that happened, though, sin took advantage of him, because now you are accountable. And here's what happens when you violate my rule, God says. Sin taking occasion, verse 11, by the commandment deceived me, and by it killed me. Now you notice all through the section, verses 8 through 12, verse 8, the commandment, verse 9, the commandment, verse 10, the commandment, verse 11, the commandment, verse 12, the commandment. The law is holy, the commandment, holy, just, and good. He's saying the commandment over and over and over and over and over again, because had there been no commandment, there could have been no violation of it. Let me pause here. Are there any comments? I don't take questions because I don't know the answer to questions, but I'll take any comments. If there are questions, I'll just say, Lee, what do you say about that? Anything? Okay, if I go too fast, just wave me down. In verse 13, so then he says, has this thing that is good become death to me? Are you trying to tell me that this good law, what he just said in verse 12, it's holy and just and good, can this good thing God gave me, can it actually be death to me? The law can bring death? You think it's a good law when they say, don't drive 110 miles an hour on the interstate around here? You think it's a good law? What if somebody violates it? Does he think it's a good law? Probably not. It's a good law when they find him doing that. And they give him 30 days in the clink, and a huge fine and take away his license and all this. He says, what a rotten law that is. Whether you like the law or not, whether the law is good or not, in a person's subjective opinion depends upon what he's trying to do with it. If he doesn't want to obey it, it's going to be rotten anytime. Any law is going to be rotten. He wants to be an antinomian, which means I'm against all law. He wants to make a law that there be no law. Sounds contradictory, doesn't it? And then the other one who says, well, we need laws. If we don't have laws, somebody could just come into Jonathan's house and say, Jonathan, there are no laws. I'm just going to shoot you and take everything you have. What could Jonathan do to plead with him? Could he say, if you do that, the police will... No, the police aren't going to do anything. There's no such thing as a law. Do you really want to live in a society without law? No. So we agree the law is good, don't we? We agree the law is good. So, has what has good become death to me? Certainly not. That's another one of those no's. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good. There's his word good again. Three times he's called it good. Verse 12 and now twice in verse 13. The law is good. But sin is producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment, there's the commandment again, we saw in verses 8 through 12. That sin by the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. What does that mean? Well, I was raised in the country. And so that explains a lot about me. I don't know very much. But let's suppose I go to town for the first time. I've never even seen a stoplight. And I've just learned out in the field, without any instructions, without an instruction manual, I've just learned how to work my three in the tree, old 1954 truck I used to drive. I learned how to use that thing, so I drive into town for the first time, and say, isn't that a pretty red light? And I just go right through it. And after about 10 of these, and I'm having the time of my life seeing all of this city here, I've never seen anything like this, I see these whirly lights. And I say, aren't they pretty? I wish I had those on my truck. And finally, he pulls me over. He makes me turn over on the side of the road, and he says, come. Let me see your driver's license. I said, my what? He said, why did you go through that red light? What do you mean go through it? I thought it was pretty. I'll give you credit for a pretty town. And he sees how ignorant I am. What you going to do to me? Well, we'll just leave that where it is. He sends me, no telling where, but after I get out, I go back home and I have an instruction manual. If I'm not restricted from driving the rest of my life, I have an instruction manual. I said, oh, that red light means stop. And yellow doesn't mean put the pedal to the metal, it means slow down. And green means go. I wish I had known that the first time. I could have saved myself a lot of trouble. That's what he's saying here in verse 13. The clearer the commandment is to us, the clearer my knowledge of what I've done when I violate it. So that when I go through the red light, if I go through another one, now after reading the manual, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Now I know I've done wrong. That's what Paul says the commandment has done. It has shown us clearly that sin might appear to be exceedingly sinful. How horrible is that? When I didn't know the law, I flaunted it in ignorance. When I know the law, now I know how I'm to behave. And when I violate it then, as I'm going to, I know what I am and I know what I deserve. Then in verse 14, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I'm carnal, sold under sin. Just as King Ahab, we may get to this in a moment, sold himself to do evil. 1 Kings 21, he married Jezebel and he sold himself to do evil. Paul says, I'm sold under sin. For what I am doing, I don't understand. For what I will to do, I don't end up doing it. And what I hate, that's what I end up doing. So if I do what I don't want to do, I agree with the law that it's good. I say, I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be going through those red lights. Yet I find myself doing it. I'm in a hurry. I've been behind slow drivers. And I force the issue. I know better. And I find that's the general tenor of my life. I know better and I keep doing things I know I'm not to do. I keep ignoring things I know I'm required to do. So verse 17, now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. Whoever dwells in me controls me. If you dwell in your house, you control that house. You determine how the air conditioner is set. You determine how the heat is set. You determine whether the blinds are open and the windows are open and what time you get up. You determine all that takes place in the house. If you dwell in it, you control it. Here he's saying sin dwells in me. If sin dwells in me, sin is controlling me. And then he says, verse 18, I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. Well, I guess so. If sin is in control, then nothing good is influencing me. I'm under the influence of bad. For to will is present with me, to how to perform what is good, I do not find. I know I need to do good. I just don't know how. For the good that I want to do, I don't do it. And the evil that I don't want to do, that's what I end up doing. I have great intentions, but I just don't put them in practice. How frustrating. So he says, verse 20, now if I do what I don't want to do, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. So in verse 17 and verse 20, it's sin who's controlling me. I'm the house and sin is in control. I find then a law, a principle, that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. So here's a law or a principle, the law of sin. Sin is controlling me. But then in verse 22, a different law, a second law, for I delight in the law of God. That's what he's been talking about here. So you have this same issue he's been talking about. You have the law of God. God gave rules. Then you have sin. And sin can become so dominant in my life that it controls me instead of the law of God. And all the while, mentally, I'm saying, I want to do what God says. But in actuality, I'm saying, I want to do what I want to do. My flesh overpowers my better judgment. And I sin. So then in verse 23, he's saying, I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind. I am a walking civil war. My mind says no, my body says yes. And I have this constant tug of war, this struggle that pulls at me every day, Paul says. And he says, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin. What he said in verse 21, this law of sin, he's repeating it here in verse 23. The law of my mind, that's what he said in verse 22, the law of God. He's talking about two laws, and he's mentioned both of them twice. Verse 21, the law of sin. Verse 23, this law of sin, he mentions it again. Verse 22, the law of God, that's the law he's been talking about, the law of Moses. And then he says in verse 23, the law of my mind. Another way of saying the law that's telling my mind what to do, and it agrees, but my body does something else. Now, verse 24, oh, wretched man that I am. How miserable. How miserable to go through life knowing what I need to be doing and doing the opposite. Planning it in the mind, destroying it with the body. Who will deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. There's the solution. There's where all this is going. There's where the law fits in. The law was designed to bring us to Christ, to fall upon our knees and say, this is what it was all about. Every word of the Old Testament was pointing toward Christ. And that's what he's trying to get these brethren to see. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with the mind, I myself serve the law of God. That's what he said in verse 22 and verse 23. The law of God, the law of my mind. With my mind, oh, I'm 100% in agreement with God. If I read the law, that's what I believe. That's what I want to do. That's what I want to be. But with the flesh, the law of sin. Now, just so we'll know, he mentions a third law in chapter 8. The law, verse 2, the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus, the new law. And then he's going to make that contrast in chapter 2 between the new law and what it can do and the lack of condemnation and the forgiveness as opposed to the law that could merely point out my faults, but it could not forgive me of them. It couldn't actually take away the problem. Okay, that's a whole lot at once. Any comments? Oh, very good. It must have been a perfect explanation. I'll flatter myself because nobody else will. Okay. Let's look now. Let's go through the verses. Do you have questions here when you go over, or you forego those today? Because I didn't do my questions. Do I?
Today we have forgotten.
Today we have forgotten. Okay. Do what?
Go ahead.
If you have any questions, you can talk among yourselves. Okay. In verse 1. Do you not know, brethren? And then, parenthetically, he says, now, I'm speaking to those who know law. You know what law is. The word the is added by the translators. It's just, if you know law, you know the function of law, the purpose of law. So I'm speaking to those who know law. That the law has dominion over man as long as he lives. When you die, do you have to worry about red lights anymore? You don't have to worry about it anymore. It's no more pertaining to you. I almost said when you die, you don't have to pay taxes. But they can reach into the grave and you have to pay taxes even when you're dead. But you don't worry about it. Your family will. So he says, the law has dominion over man as long as he lives. You remember there was a man in one of the previous presidential administrations in the 1990s, they were investigating him. He was being charged with some pretty serious charges. And in the midst of that investigation, his plane crashed. Do you know what happened immediately when his plane crashed and he died? They stopped the investigation. You don't have to prosecute a dead man. That's what he's saying here. The law has dominion over man as long as he lives. The legal maxim is death cancels all contracts. Once you're dead, that's it. So he goes on then to illustrate this with this these couple, one dies and the other is free. Now in verse 7, for what shall we say then? Is the law sin? No, I'm not blaming law, Paul says. But there is a connection between law and sin. There is a connection between them. If there were no law, there could be no transgression. I again refer you to chapter 4, verse 15. Shall we say then, is the law sin? Certainly not. No. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through law. Now, we have a puzzle here. I remember in James 1, 14, James makes the point. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. How do you know of sin? Well, because of something in you. Here he's saying we know sin because of something that is objectively presented to us in God's will. Well, they're both true. It's not an either-or situation, is it? When God tells us the way it is and our desire chooses something else, then that's what sin is. So he says, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. Now, the Pharisees' view of covetousness was, if you don't commit some overt act, then you're okay. If you beat a fellow to within half inch of his life, but you haven't killed him, then you're not guilty of murder. And Jesus points out in Matthew 5, no, you don't be angry with him, because that's the first step toward that direction. The Pharisees, if you don't commit the overt act of adultery, you're okay. Jesus said, well, if you look at a woman for the purpose of lusting after her in your heart, you've already committed adultery in your heart. He pointed out there's far more involved. He's dealing with covetousness. And I find it interesting. I think mostly today when we Americans talk about covetousness, we think of, I want a bigger house and bigger car and better furniture and more money and a bigger bank account and bigger vacations and all this. We a greedy desire for more. That's what covetousness is. But in the original proclamation of this in Exodus 20, verse 17, the tenth of the Ten Commandments, you're not to covet after your neighbor's wife. That's not just a possession. That's a sensual desire. Now, I find it interesting that in Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3, Paul will use that same word covetousness in a context. He's talking about fornication and uncleanness. Fornication, uncleanness, and covetousness. It sounds like he's harking back to the general use of that term that includes not just these things. It does include the possessions and so on, like the rich man in Luke 12, but also the sensual desires. Whatever you covet, that becomes your God. An idol is what you set up in your heart, and it becomes between you and your Father in heaven. So he's saying here then that covetousness is something, Paul says, I learned because the law said you shall not covet. Let me just mention.
Yeah, but wait, can you put covetousness, covet in modern parlance?
Greedy desire for more. When you have a greedy desire for more, when you have this consuming desire, it's not a mere desire that says, you know, I would like to better myself and my family situation. That's not necessarily crossing a line, but you can cross a line where it becomes a greedy desire for more, and we have to use some judgment in defining what that is.
How is it related to a strong desire?
I think they're the same. A strong desire is the same. This is the word basically for desire here, and in Exodus 20, verse 17 as well. He'll use the word desire. You shall not covet, you shall not desire. Instead of me defining, just look around at the United States, at most people. They're grasping for more and more stuff. That's what it is. And it, as I said, there's a sensual aspect of it too. I don't know if that's his main focus here. But I find it interesting that only God could make a law and enforce it against covetousness. Have you ever heard of the Supreme Court in the United States saying, yes, you shall not covet? What would they do if someone did? How would they know? They don't know what you think. Now, with the NSA, they may be trying, but they can't really tell what you think, but God even judges thoughts. That's how significant this is. Let me just mention this. These first seven verses, I was knocking on doors several years ago. I came to this door and this giant of a man came. And I said, we'd like to invite you to a Bible study. He said, let me see that. He said, I'm a preacher. I walked around, but that's good. He said, yeah, I'll talk to you. He came to the house and he started telling me all kinds of things. It was a pretty interesting talk. But one of the things he told me was, he said, we need to be keeping the Ten Commandments. And I said, well, would you do me a favor? Would you read, right now, would you read the first seven verses of Romans 7? He sat down and he read. And for 5 minutes, he didn't utter a sound. His nose was in the text. He read it again. And he said, it says the Ten Commandments are done away. I didn't know that before. And of course, Galatians 3, 2 Corinthians 3, several passages do that. But this is a very strong passage to help people see. that one of the illustrations Paul's using, this is not some ceremonial law, like we no longer offer burnt sacrifices. This is covetousness, one of the ten. The Ten Commandments are going to what? Now, does that mean we can covet? No, that's forbidden in the New. All of them are forbidden in the New, except the one that is the Sabbath, and that one is one of the strongest ones of all, and it's appealed to us because of Hebrews 4. We're looking forward to the permanent Sabbath and our final rest. Our final rest. But we don't have a seventh-day weekly Sabbath now, but all of the other nine are pointed out to us. Now, this moral requirement of the law, he says, I learned by reading what God had said to me. Now, let me in view of this, look, Paul is saying here, I don't want you to get the impression that I'm blaming the law on what I'm saying. The law did its job very well. Its purpose is not to make men sinners, but to command, tell us what to do. Paul says it told us what not to do, it prohibited, and it showed us what sin is. That's very important, isn't it? That's what you'd expect law to do. Covetousness is his example that he uses. He could have used any of these ten. And I find it interesting, the rich young ruler said, well, I've kept all these commandments. He didn't even know the first one about God, and he didn't know the last one about covetousness. And when Jesus gave him a command to get rid of these things that are occupying your heart and dominating your life, he was unwilling to, showing that he still had an idol in his heart. He didn't know about God as he should. Without law, Paul says, I wouldn't have known this was a sin. I wouldn't have known covetousness was a sin. We come into this world, and all we think about is, feed me, clean me, get me to sleep, keep me warm. It's all about me, me, me. You know anything about that, Lee? And so that's what we all do. And you never grow out of this unless you mature and you learn God's law. Some people never grow out of it. It's all about me. Just give me, give me, give me. Now, he goes on in verse 8. Stop me at any point or if we go too fast. He says, but sin taking opportunity. Sin sets up a military base. That's what the word means. By the commandment. Produced in me all manner of evil desire. Notice his parallel statements. In verse 7, I had not known sin except through law. In verse 8, he calls it the commandment. In verse 7, he uses the word covetousness. In 8, it produced in me all manner of evil desire. He's saying the same thing in different words. He's repeating himself. He hasn't changed his topic. Sin took a base of operations. Remember Daniel 6. Daniel is leading an exemplary life. If anybody ever tried to keep the law of God, it was Daniel. And the men who were jealous of him, his rivals, said, we will never find a way to accuse Daniel before the king unless what? What did they say? His connection to the law of his God. So they set up this rule. Darius, nobody can pray to anybody for this 30-day period except to you. Well, Daniel goes and he prays regularly and they catch him and he throws him to the lion's den. All right. They used Daniel's righteousness as an opportunity to destroy him. That's what Satan did in Genesis 3 with Eve. And it's what you see throughout Scripture. Sin taking opportunity by the commandment produced in me all manner of evil desire. It brought about, just as Eve said, why should I not be allowed to have this? Have you ever noticed that people tend to focus on what they cannot do instead of being glad for the things they can do? Children especially. You mean I can't go over there and do what that boy is doing? Here are 100,000 other things he could do. Many of them more fun than what that kid's doing. And all he focuses on, that one thing you won't let me do. Oh, my life is ruined. Isn't that the way grown-ups act too? The one thing we can't do. That's what he's talking about here. Then he says, for apart from the law, sin was dead. That's chapter 4, verse 15. Where there's no law, what? There's no transgression. So, no law, no sin. I was alive once without the law. So here's the order. He was alive. The commandment came. We reached an age of accountability. Sin revived. Sin got another victim. And he says, I died. He wasn't born this way. He wasn't born dead. but it's only in connection with his violation of law that this occurred. Al Capone, you know who Al Capone was. I date myself now when I talk about Al Capone. I didn't live during this period, but I knew who he was. Al Capone in Chicago, great bootlegger and many things, spent time at Alcatraz. He said, the prohibition made many sinners. The prohibition made many sinners. Is he right? He's right. So, we should do away with prohibition. Don't tell people not to drink. No, it's a good law. It actually did good things, but you don't ever hear about those. It's a good law. But if you're going to have a law, you're going to have violations of it. Out in Arizona, a few years ago, they got tired of having terrible crime statistics because so many people were driving into service stations, getting gas and driving away without paying for it. And they said, some bright councilman said, I know what we need to do. Let's just say that's not a law. So now you can drive into the service station, get your gas, and drive away without any paying. That's a wonderful rule, isn't it? So their crime stats go down. There are not as many transgressors because we've justified the sin. Now, if there were no law, there'd be no transgressors. That's what Paul is saying. Verse 10, and the commandment which was to bring life. He's talking about commandment again, like verse 8. The commandment which was to bring life, I found to bring death. The commandment, Satan used as an opportunity to get me to sin. Eve, you want that fruit. God is holding back. What about all this other fruit? Oh, it's nothing compared to this one. You haven't lived till you've eaten that fruit. Sin comes. When sin comes, death arrives. It took this sequence, the command, sin, and death. And that's what Paul is saying in verse 10. Why do you give rules to your children? Is it because you want to catch them so you can go beat the tar out of them? No, you want to train them how to live, isn't it? You want to train them to be responsible young people. Verse 11, for sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me and by it killed me. So sin stands for the tempter here, what the tempter did. That's Mr. Sin, personified. Sin is first said, oh, I'll get you. I know how to get you. And then verse 12, therefore the law is holy and the commandment holy, just, and good. If it's holy, it's pure. If it's just, that means it's right. If I don't do what it says, I'm wrong. The law is right. Don't blame God, blame yourself. And it's good. That means it's beneficial. It will help you. It will bless you. It will help you lead the life you need to live. But in verse 13, has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not. But sin, that it might appear sin. Imagine straight edge. Here's a straight edge. See this? Sin is very crooked. You don't see how crooked it is. If you go like this, you think, oh, sin's not so bad. That's a white line. It's not so bad. It's almost totally straight. But you put it against this and you say, oh, the law magnifies what sin is. There's no such thing as a little white lie. All liars have their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, Revelation 21:8. Okay, but sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good. It's as though the enemy rushes me, takes my sword, and kills me with my own way. Here's the law. The law is good, Paul says. But the enemy rushes in, and he takes my own sword, the very commandment I wanted to keep, and he stabs me with my own weapon. That's what's happening here. So he says, it was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin, through the commandment, might become exceedingly sinful. Let me ask you something. When sin rushes in upon me and takes my sword and kills me, do you blame the sword? Is it the sword's fault? Did it just jump up and say, look what I can do to you, and just whack me to pieces? No, it's the enemy who's misusing the sword. That's what he's saying here. Now, in verse 14. By the way, comments? Before we go, I'm getting behind the chart, so let me run through a real quick chart test for you here. Sin personified, opportunity, that's a base for military operations. Sin used law to do its work. Genesis 3, 1 through 6 illustrates this principle. We've said that, so I'm going to need to elaborate. Satan used the opportunity afforded by the commandment to lead Eve into sin. Romans 7, 9, I was alive once, before he reached the age of accountability. The word order, alive, he was innocent. The command came, he was accountable. Sin sprang to life, he died, he was killed. because of his violation of the law. Total hereditary depravity would have reversed their order and said, I started out dead, I inherited it from Adam. Nothing like that in this text. In fact, it cannot be. You can't believe that in this text. But now, Romans 7:10-11, the purpose of the commandment was life. The result of the commandment was death. The purpose is life. It's to help you. It's to bless you. If you had kept that law perfectly, you would have been right with God. But who did? Only Jesus. So the result was death. The reason? He says, I sinned. Sin deceived him, as in 2 Corinthians 11:3, as a serpent beguiles Eve. I'm afraid that's what's going to happen to you in Corinth, Paul says. Sin killed him, and then Romans 7:12, it's holy, just, and good. The problem then is not the law, is it? The problem is sin and what sin is doing. So should we just eliminate the law? No. Some people blame laws instead of the criminals, and that's not what we're allowed to do. Law showed sin in its true colors. It's exceedingly sinful. The straight edge of the law against the crookedness of sin. And now, when Paul starts in verse 14, for, that connects with what he's just been saying. He's not starting a new topic. He's on the same subject. He's talking about the law. So the question comes in, what about this effort on my part to do what the law says, and yet I fall miserably? Well, Paul represents here, when he says I, he's representing this frustrated Jew who had tried to keep the law but failed. I can be used in various ways. And Paul does this repeatedly in New Testament. It can be of his own experience. He can say, as in Galatians 1, I labored more abundantly than all the others. 1 Corinthians 15:10, Galatians 1, I outstripped all those who were my companions. It can be typical. He can use his experience to typify another. All of them. Almost all the Old Testament prophecies do this. It can be fictive. There's no personal reference involved. Where he will say, let's look at this and see if this might help us a little. In Romans 13, he's not the one needing the help, but he's saying it for their benefit. And he puts himself on their level as to say, I'll benefit from this too. But it's really they who are in the great need here. And then it's used in a polite way, as in Galatians 2, verse 18, where again, Paul, in speaking to the Galatians, says, for if I build, again, those things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. Now, Paul hadn't done that. Peter had. But Paul's being very polite and saying, but if I do this, then here's the consequence. Now, there are other uses, too, but this shows us that it doesn't have to be that Paul is saying, here is the experience I went through, and I wasn't a very good servant back in those days, though Paul was in sin. He uses somebody as the present tense. That's a very common thing. 1 Timothy 1:15, I'm a persecutor and a blasphemer and an insolent person. He's saying he is. He uses the present tense, but he's not those anymore. The present tense has nothing to do with this applying to Paul personally. People say, well, we experience this tug of war. Yes, we do. Galatians 5 is your passage that discusses the Christian as he experiences this tug of war. But he doesn't use the expressions there that he uses here. We'll see more about that in just a minute. Somebody says, only a Christian could struggle like this. Well, people of the world don't struggle. Oh, I beg to differ. Romans 2 shows that even the Gentiles had this conscience. And when that conscience stabbed them because they hadn't lived up to what that conscience told them they ought to do or ought not to do, that was basically the same thing you had here. They had a horrible conscience problem in the ancient world. A drunkard may admit his sins, but still keep running drinking. Now, various quotes show, as in Ovid's case, the famous Latin poet, desire counsels me in one direction, reason in another. Now, that's not a Christian. But isn't that the same thing Paul is representing in Romans 7? It is. Reason is telling me one thing. Counsel or desire is saying something else. He even uses the word desire. Ovid again. I see the better part to prove it, but I follow the worse. Paul couldn't have said that much better, except Paul's writing the inspiration. Plautus. I knew what I ought to be, but unhappy that I am, I could not do it. Or Seneca, one of the advisors to Nero, said, what is it? What then is it that when we would go in one direction, drags us in the other? He was a famous Stoic. And then Epictetus, a very famous slave whose master has broken his leg. He was twisting his leg as punishment. And Epictetus says, if you keep doing that, it's going to break. And it broke. He said, see, I told you. And we have some of his writings left, very, very well-known writings, a very famous Stoic around the first century. He who sins does not what he would and does what he would not. So you see, this is something that all people have come to deal with because we live in bodies and with the conscience that God has made. Yes, sir.
You seem to be pulling the Paul and arguing against something that you're arguing against the abuse of this passage, I think.
Yes.
I don't remember hearing you state the abuse. Or who does it or what the abuse is.
It's because it's Tim Till and I'm really hurting. There are those who say, well, this cannot... they say this is referring to Paul before he became a Christian. Or it's referring parts even more. They're saying it refers to Paul now as a Christian.
Who says that and why?
A number of Christians believe that's what this is saying, and they do it because it uses the present tense. They do it because only a Christian could feel this way, those things. So they say, this is referring to a Christian. And believe me, I know, all of us know, the tug of war. That's not an issue. That's why I say, Galatians 5 is specifically addressing Christians on this. But there are terms that are used here that I don't believe would fit a Christian. For example, I'm a slave, I'm sold under sin, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Paul's point is to show you are delivered by the gospel of Christ. Because what he's done, that has happened. As much as I understand this tug of war and this battle that goes on, that rages, it pulls us one way away from what God wants, that's all true. But this passage, I don't believe, can be brought over to prove that point. This is talking about a person who's not a Christian. So Paul, as a Christian, is not saying, this is what I'm going through. There dwells in me no good thing. He's going to show in chapter 8, the Spirit dwells in me. Is that no good thing? I don't believe this can be made to fit that pattern. The Jew trained under the law understood sin, but the law could not deliver him. You see all kinds of illustrations of this. Job, he confesses himself vile before this God whom he thought he wanted to have this discussion with. And when God starts talking, he shut up and he said, no, I've said too much already. Isaiah, I'm a man of unclean lips in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Luke 5, Lord, depart from me, I am a sinful man, Peter says. He falls at his knees. Luke 18:13, Lord, be merciful to me, the sinner. As this poor publican bows his head and won't even look in the direction of God. This is the idea. A Jew trained under law understood sin, but he also knew he was not delivered from that sin. Paul's purpose is not to answer questions about a Christian's struggles with sin. That's not the purpose of this point. This goes all the way back, as we've shown in chapter 7, to talk about the purpose of the law in God's plan. Law and commandment occur some 35 times, starting in chapter 7 through chapter 8, verse 4. 35 times. That's what he's emphasizing. The law, what it could not do. Not the gospel, what it cannot do. And then, this we've talked about, that would be the summary. Sold under sin. Over here he says, you better not be sold under sin. Sin dwells in me? You better know that sin dwells in you. There is in me no good thing. The Holy Spirit's in me. Do not good but evil. That's what I find. Don't you know you're raised to walk in a newness of life? I'm a captive to the law of sin. He said, no, you've been set free. You're once a captive, you've been set free. I'm a wretched man. From chapter 6, verse 6, quite the opposite. Who will rescue me? He shows. Who will rescue him? The body of death. Here's a different use of that expression. Then a slave to the law of sin. No longer. So that's what I would say, by the way, illustrating the fact that this is not referring to someone right now. You have two choices before you. We can go on for 5 more minutes and finish the text, or we can say, I've had all I can take. My head is about to explode. We need to quit. What do you want to do? 5 minutes? Take 5 more? Is that what you want to do? Okay, I don't abuse you in any way. Okay, though I will if I have to. Okay. All right, so in verse 14, we know the law is spiritual, but I'm carnal, sold under sin. I'm an Ahab, 1 Kings 21:20, who I married Jezebel, and all I'm doing is wicked stuff. All right, 15, for what I am doing, I do not understand. I don't thoroughly realize, I certainly don't approve of it. I do not understand, for what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. I don't always do what I want to do, but I do what I hate. Now again, we can understand how that could happen. I'm on a diet, and I'm determined I'm not going to touch ice cream. But by the end of the day, I've eaten 3 gallons. I was determined not to do this. Does anybody here relate to that at all? That's what he's saying, only a little more serious than ice cream. And then he says in 16, if then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it's good. Congressmen for years have passed laws. Several years ago they passed a law that came down as hard as it could on an adult who would have immoral relations with a minor. And within 6 weeks of passing the law, guess what happened? A congressman was caught violating the very law he said should be enforced. That's what Paul is saying here. Your hurting conscience proves you really agree with the law, though you're doing something else. But 17, but now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. If a thief slips in but doesn't stay, he's an intruder. He doesn't control your house, does he? But if he moves in to live, and he dwells there, and he's powerful enough, he pushes you out. He controls that house. That's what's happening to this person's body. Then verse 18, for I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. He's not saying that he's unable to accomplish even one good thing. He's agreeing with the law of all things. But nothing good dwells in him. The key is the word dwells. I'm not letting the good control me. Remember, who dwells in the house controls? The good is not controlling me. For to will is present. My will says, do God's obedience. But to perform what is good, I do not find it. How to do it? How to accomplish this? I don't know. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Now, if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. So, in verse 17, sin dwells in me. Verse 18, nothing good dwells in my flesh. Verse 20, sin dwells in me. He's emphasizing who is my leader. Though I acknowledge with my lips God is the one I want to serve, sin is saying, you're going to do what I say. He has taken over my house. Verse 21, I find then a law, a rule, a principle, fact of life, that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. So there are two eyes and there are two laws. I find a law. The evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. I will to do good, but I don't have the power. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. So the eye of verse 21 is the eye of verse 22. I find this rule. I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. I seek to control my body with my mind that's influenced by Scripture. But I see another law in my members. I'm a one-man civil war. Two authorities are saying, do this, and they're polar opposites. Do this. No, do that. Remember the little cartoons? An angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other. That's his man. And in the cartoon, as I remember, he always flicked away the angel and did what the little devil wanted him to do. Well, that's this. I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. So it's brought me into captivity. I'm a prisoner of war to sin. I'm a prisoner of war. And then verse 24, oh, wretched man that I am. I had a distant cousin who all his life was addicted to alcohol. You could see him walking down the street, wobbling back and forth, and I felt so sorry for him. Yeah, I heard people say, oh, poor guy. Poor guy. He wanted to quit, and he tried so much, and just never did. That's this. Oh, wretched man that I am. How miserable. He no longer controls his life. Someone else is telling him what to do. And how often. Who will deliver me from this body of death? That's the plea. Paul says, I'm a loser. I wasn't a born loser because we saw he was born pure, but I'm a loser. Who will deliver me from this body of death? I'm a walking dead man. I know what I'm awaiting. Let me out of here. So in verse 25, I thank God. The plea is verse 24. The answer is verse 25, the first part. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. There is the exclamation. There is the answer. There's the solution. I need to come to Christ. So then, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. The drowning man needs a Savior, and Jesus is the one whom Paul sets forth as that Savior voice. Thank you very, very much for your excellent attention. I know this was a whole lot in a short time. It's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. But thank you for hanging in there.